Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I'm absolutely delighted to have Mike Benz with us, who's been doing fantastic work on the Epstein files. I mean, you know, mainstream media is all over the salacious components here. Prince Andrew, Bill Gates, etc. But it's the apparatus above these stories that is what is most important, because that apparatus, I believe, remains intact until this day. So Mike is really breaking it down, you know, in terms of the Maxwell, Khashoggi, Bank of Credit and Commerce International nexus and the history of how this apparatus came into being and Epstein's role in it, and no, you know, nowhere near the top. So huge thank you for coming on, my friend, and congratulations on all your followers on X.
Thanks. Yeah, what you just said there, I think, is right in the heart of it. Everybody's heard, I think, all their lifetime about how, you know, the government can be controlled by banks or banking interests, how there's this shady web that connects intelligence services to private companies, to geopolitical events. And what we're seeing in the Jeffrey Epstein story, above and beyond the obviously extremely foul and criminal things involving, you know, underage girls or trafficking women or the like, is really a glimpse behind, you know, deep into the looking glass of that sticky layer between the private sector and government, between banks and public policy, between intelligence services and the go-betweens they use for, you know, engaging in everything from money laundering to, you know, setting people up, the fixer class.
Yeah, we've had Ari Ben-Meneshi on a couple of times talking about the history of it as well. So how do you feel that Jeffrey Epstein crossed over into intelligence?
Well, I think it happened very early. I think when he was in his 20s, there's a, and then let me, I guess, preface this by saying that I don't know or even strongly believe that Epstein was formally intelligence in the classic sense that is always well documented within an agency. So, for example, the CIA has something called a 201 file for a personality file that they create on employees and assets, formal assets, people that they are running, that are being handled by a case officer, that are being effectively working in some sense for the agency. There's a broader class of people who don't work for the agency, but work with the agency when it's good for both of them. So you can pick it up, put it down. And I believe that this happened with Jeffrey Epstein, the working with at least the CIA, but very likely the Israelis, the Saudis, the Brits, the French. But the in the late 1970s, there's been a lot of talk about Bear Stearns, the firm that Jeffrey Epstein worked for from 1976 to 1981, just over 4 years in that span. And he was brought to the firm by Ace Greenberg, who at the time was a senior executive, and within 2 years would become CEO. Ace Greenberg set Jeffrey Epstein up with his daughter. They were dating. So he's kind of brought in as a protege, dating the CEO's daughter, brought in on all the lucrative deals. Well, one of the most lucrative sources of deal flow for Bear Stearns at the time was a CIA bank called BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, also called Bank of Crooks and Criminals International. It was set up to in Pakistan in 1972. By 1976, it was running guns to the Mujahideen, who today are more colloquially known as Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the kind of Islamo-terror groups that were bastards as they were. They were our bastards, so to speak, from the 1970s through the 1990s. That was the group that Osama bin Laden belonged to. Osama bin Laden was receiving CIA payments, as was his entire collective terrorist army to kill the Russians. And so in order to do this covert funding, the CIA needed a bank and a money launderer to do it. The money launderer was a group called Capcom, which was owned 50% by the head of Saudi intelligence. And it was a close partner of BCCI. Basically, you need a bank, a money launderer, and a clearinghouse to make these things work. And so you had the bank being BCCI, where the CIA kept accounts, where the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, ran a whole slush fund, where you had Capcom doing mirrored trades with itself. Basically, this was a money laundering technique to set up shell entities to trade with it, with each other, so that by at the end of the transaction, the money's clean. You can start with drug money and then lose it to yourself, and then have the new entity yourself have money that's not won by drugs, but won because of a fair market trade, and that's supposed to be caught by the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse is who basically does the know your customer, anti-money laundering. That the one of the top three biggest clearinghouses was in fact Bear Stearns, while Jeffrey Epstein was at Bear Stearns. Jeffrey Epstein left Bear Stearns nominally in 1981 under the hail of an SEC investigation when he was giving a hot deals, that is pre-IPO shares that he was selling to friends. For Edgar Bronfman. Edgar Bronfman at the time was the head of the World Jewish Congress, which at the time was morphing from a kind of civil society advocacy role to a kind of shadow diplomacy, shadow Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Edgar Bronfman himself was deeply involved in Iranian shadow diplomacy. In 1979, the Iranian Revolution happened. This is what basically kicked the CIA, MI6 installed Shah out of Iran, and then caused the geopolitical earthquake that we are still dealing with and trying to undo. But also at the time, you had the Iraqis trying to invade Iran, and we were afraid that Saddam Hussein was going to basically get geopolitical hegemony over the entire Middle East. So you had this joint U.S., U.K., Israeli foreign policy that was being administered at the government level by the executive branch and their intelligence services, but being facilitated at the financial level by Bear Stearns, the bank that Jeffrey Epstein was working in. So, you know, one of the frustrations is that walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, talks like a duck, probably a duck. Now we're still waiting for hard confirmation Epstein physically worked on the BCCI deals. It's frustrating. The New York Times ran something like a 20,000 word article where they interviewed three of his bosses and about 12 of his associates while he was at Bear Stearns. And they said, Epstein worked on the most lucrative deals. He worked on these, oil and pipeline deals that we know that BCCI was involved with. They didn't actually name the deals, though. So it'd be very easy, for example, if Congress were to pass some sort of CIA Transparency Act where we could actually get the, just like for the Justice Department originated documents that we have now, if we were to be able to get the CIA originated documents, we would be able to get a lot more data on that early 1980s period. Also, if someone could simply re-interview the three bosses that Jeffrey Epstein, the three bosses of Jeffrey Epstein that the New York Times talked to, they would be able to ask, when you said the most lucrative deals, Bear Stearns cleared $13 billion in current money of BCCI trades. Those deals had to be personally signed off on by Ace Greenberg, the CEO of the company who was Jeffrey Epstein's mentor. It sounds like he was put on those deals. And if that was the case, then it's a wrap. I mean, that explains how Jeffrey Epstein was flying back and forth to London in 1982 to meet Sir Douglas Leese, who was one of the most prolific arms dealers in the UK, who was running those illegal arms with the CIA during the Iran-Contra affair. That would explain how Jeffrey Epstein, when he went out on his own at the tender age of 30, was handling the money for Adnan Khashoggi. Adnan Khashoggi was one of the biggest bankers at BCCI, the CIA bank. Adnan Khashoggi personally flew to Washington to meet with the CIA and to meet with the U.S. National Security Council to serve as the Saudi back channel between the Americans and the Israelis on those very gun deals that Bear Stearns was facilitating. So it seems pretty clear to me that even by the early 80s, Jeffrey Epstein was probably smiling to himself about the weird world he had got himself caught up in, and probably bragging to people that he was working for the CIA as a kind of New York City cocktail party, self-flex. It's widely reported in the 2001 Evening Standard, for example. It was reported that Jeffrey Epstein used to tell people that he worked for the CIA, but now he denies it. That itself is consistent with what I just said. But in addition to that, it's worth noting 2 years earlier, we now know from the Epstein files, Jeffrey Epstein FOIA'd the CIA for all open and acknowledged agency links between the CIA and himself. That to me suggests that Epstein knew he was in a sticky middle layer where he knew that he had done work with the agency, but didn't know if the agency had, because that was not an official relationship, if the agency had acknowledged any links. When that came back as no, 2 years later, he became a public figure.
Well said, Mike. We love long, detailed answers on this channel. And oddly enough, I was a stockbroker in America in the 90s, and Bear Stearns was our clearing firm. So, I'm very familiar with how that worked. So we've got this official narrative of Ghislaine Maxwell mourning her father's death, comes to the US, meets Jeffrey, which other people have told us is a crock of. How do you believe that Ghislaine and Jeffrey were introduced?
Well, I think it's through these same networks. The fact is, you know, it's widely reported that Robert Maxwell was, even though he ran this British publishing house empire, that he was effectively an Israeli agent. And now, whether or not that was formal or not, the fact is, the funeral for him in Israel, the publications that came out from multiple high level Israeli intelligence folks afterwards, make it seem pretty apparent that Maxwell had this British and Israeli intelligence function in addition to running this media empire. Now, this, of course, is, just like with the Epstein case, this is not altogether unusual in the genre, if you will, because there was this joint foreign policy coordination between the U.S., the U.K., and Israel. This is, in fact, part of the bedrock of the alliance. If there are, government policy for the most part, I wish it weren't so, but government policy for the most part is not done on the basis of what's best for the people of a given democracy. It's done for what's best for the donors and oligarchs of a country who pay for the political campaigns and who allow political figures to make huge sums of money on the outside if they do well for those donors while they're in office. And so it wasn't really until the 2015 Iran deal under Obama that there became this pretty deep schism between US, UK, and Israeli foreign policy. And then a year and a half later, Trump got elected, and then it became sort of a factional dispute between the marquee power players in our own intelligence state and in the Brits and in versus sort of the Trump movement and the current Likud party in Israel. But effectively, Ghislaine Maxwell was the daughter of a spy, and there's a fairly credible account, at least in my estimation. I think it's very interesting. There was an account in a book about how Robert Maxwell appears to have sponsored advertising for effectively the Ronald Reagan campaign in the 1980s, that effectively tarnished the Jimmy Carter CIA, who immediately preceded Ronald Reagan, and that Robert Maxwell himself was deeply involved in this these Iran geopolitics that Bear Stearns was doing the financial side of. It looks like Robert Maxwell was involved in the kind of media and publication side around. And so, you know, you swim in the same pool for long enough, you meet the other people who are in the pool. There's any number of ways that that the finance side and the media side of the same covert operation would meet each other.
Yeah, I think to understand Glenn's story, people need to understand how connected Robert Maxwell was. What kind of connections did you discover in your research that he had?
Well, I mean, as I said, he was very tied to this U.S., U.K., Israeli joint foreign policy during the Ronald Reagan administration on everything from Iran-Contra to the, you know, the U.S. presence of his publishing empire to support propaganda, to support paid media on radio and in newspapers. You know, the fact is, you know, he died in the 1990s while I guess Jeffrey Epstein was basically around 40 or so. It looks like it was around that time that Epstein, with the passage of Maxwell, that Epstein sort of moved on to Les Wexner as a primary patron. And Les Wexner himself appears to be in the same pool, if you will. Les Wexner is, you know, owns the largest residence, I believe, in Ohio. He's a major power player and king player in Ohio politics. Ohio politics itself is very deeply involved with the U.S. military. This is one of the reasons that in the United States we have this Somali immigration crisis, if you will, that's shaken American politics with all the fraud there. Ohio, the Rickenbacker Air Force Base was the place in Ohio that was used to launch the U.S. and CIA activity in Somalia after the 1991 Somali Civil War. And then we began an immigrant program in Somalia right there at that time. It's worth noting that Jeffrey Epstein and Les Wexner negotiated the transfer of Southern Air Transport to Columbus, Ohio, to that very same Rickenbacker Air Force Base in 1994. Southern Air Transport was a CIA proprietary airline. It was a spin out of Air America, and it was owned and operated solely and exclusively by the Central Intelligence Agency for 40 years until it got in a lot of trouble during the Iran-Contra affair when it was caught moving guns and allegedly drugs from back and forth from Miami and Colombia and back and forth from Nicaragua and Mina, Arkansas, while Bill Clinton was the attorney general and then governor of the state. This is the famous Barry Seal case, which you know, it involved, again, this illegal gun running and narcotics activity. Just like in Afghanistan, it was illegal gun running and narcotics activity. BCCI, the bank, was the way that the drug money for the Mujahideen was turned clean. The Mujahideen would grow the basically the poppy in the territory they own on the Golden Crescent. That's how it became responsible for 95% of the world's heroin. It would then clean the it would sell those drugs and then clean the cash through the BCCI bank and then buy guns. So it was drugs for cash for guns. It was the same thing the CIA was doing for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan with Jeffrey Epstein as the, you know, as part of that network of BCCI, if not direct, then at least adjacent network. And then you have the same thing that the CIA was doing in the next decade during the Iran-Contra scandal, when it was doing it instead of for basically the precursors to heroin to convert to cash to drugs, you know, drugs to cash to guns. They were doing it for cocaine in Latin America to help the Nicaraguans try to overthrow the Sandinistas. Well, that very airline that was doing that, Southern Air Transport, was personally negotiated by Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein to move from Miami to Columbus, Ohio, to service the Limited, right as Les Wexner gave Jeffrey Epstein durable power of attorney over the entire the Limited brand. Now, Limited Brands was the, at the time, the number one retailer in the United States in the mid-1990s, which means it would have had access to an unbelievable logistics chain to be able to move black market goods. I find it very interesting that the Limited acquired a chain of gun stores right as Southern Air Transport moved from Miami to Columbus, Ohio. I don't know if anyone in the audience thinks that they can just go out and negotiate with the CIA to have one of its airliners move from Miami to their hometown to serve their company. It makes a lot of sense if you understand Epstein's CIA adjacent activity for the 15 years preceding. Now, what's also interesting about that is that, first of all, the Limited sold those gun stores in 1998, the year that Southern Air Transport shut down. So it's like they only owned, you know, you have this basically clothing, underwear, you know, type empire that becomes, that gets into guns only and exclusively during the years when the CIA's gun-running air fleet moves to service the company. I find that extremely strange. It was also said to transport the Limited's wares back and forth on effectively a private charter between Columbus, Ohio, and Hong Kong. Well, Hong Kong was seized by the British during the Opium Wars and turned promptly into a narco state for 100 and now almost 200 years. Hong Kong is a giant source of transshipment of illegal narcotics on the Golden Triangle. And now, nominally, I think the CIA would argue, well, listen, Southern Air Transport wasn't a CIA airliner when we moved it to serve Jeffrey Epstein. Hmm. And to that, I would rebut and say, yeah, it's true. The CIA sold its controlling stake to a CIA employee for Southern Air Transport, a employee and lawyer who had been managing the, so, you know, it's basically went from official CIA to a guy who was co-running it while it was CIA and who himself was CIA. And so he's the one who, you know, basically transferred it to serve Jeffrey Epstein's logistics, you know, his logistics empire for the Limited. But the fact is it went from CIA, you know, official to, you know, CIA employee. You know, that's about as thin a layer of plausible deniability as I've ever heard in my life.
And when they reformed the companies, they brought the same directors in. Absolute scam. And I love it when the CIA investigated itself over this and gave themselves the all clear. So we've got over 2,000 watching live presently. I'm here with Mike Benz. If you're not familiar with his work, if you've been listening, the research is absolutely brilliant here about the apparatus. The mainstream media is distracting everybody with the bread and circuses, but there's this big apparatus that Epstein was a part of and causing huge changes in world events. For example, Ari Ben-Menashe came on and said that they had compromise on Bill Clinton and they used that to scupper the peace deal with Yasser Arafat when Ehud Barak was back in power. What are your thoughts on claims like that?
Well, I've heard those claims. It's tough to know. You know, it's possible that Compromat was acquired but not deployed. I would think that even if you know, when you deploy that kind of Compromat officially, I think that even if the person does what you want on a particular thing, word gets around and people simply distance themselves. You might win a battle that way, but you tend to lose a war. I think that would spread to the entire DNC and, you know, probably have, you know, decades of blowback if that were to be done in any sort of direct manner. You know, certainly the, you know, that information did become public around Monica Lewinsky. And, you know, So I don't know, you know, what good it necessarily would have done to say we have this when, you know, it ultimately did come out. But leaving that aside, there is a very deep relationship, obviously, between Bill Clinton and Jeffrey Epstein. Again, worth noting, Bill Clinton, before he became president in 1993, in the 1980s, was the attorney general, the head of the Justice Department in the state, and the governor of Arkansas, while MENA Arkansas served as this logistics node for Southern Air Transport, which would later become Jeffrey Epstein's effectively Southern Air Transport, Epstein and Wexner. And so it's worth noting that Epstein's relationship with this, with the White House, was a very curious one. It's one that we are still waiting for Bill Clinton's deposition, or at least public hearing, to explain. But basically, Epstein, we know, at least 17 times got a White House visitor's pass to visit the White House. So, you know, you don't visit the White House 17 times unless you are at least consulting with the White House on various initiatives. So the question is, who did he meet with? What offices did he go to? Did he go to the West Wing? Did he go to the Eisenhower Executive Office Building? Did he meet with the National Security Council? We know that Epstein's clients were meeting with the National Security Council, like Adnan Khashoggi, in the 1980s. By the 90s, Khashoggi had gotten in a little bit of trouble, and I think that Epstein's network began to really evolve more globally beyond the kind of pure Iran-Contra network. But what's really interesting to me is that while Jeffrey Epstein was going back and forth 17 times to the White House, the State Department rented Jeffrey Epstein the what at the time was one of the largest residences in New York City, a five-story mansion that it had just seized from the government of Iran. So again, going back to this Iran foreign policy mediated by American, British, Israeli, and Saudi interests after the 1979 Iran revolution that happened while Jeffrey Epstein was at Bear Stearns, and that all of these characters were involved in either running guns to or running ops against, depending on whether Iran was losing or winning the Iran-Iraq war at the time. But yeah, so you have this enormous residence that was $15,000 a month in 1990s money. So you can imagine what that would be like today. And it seizes this five-story mansion from the government of Iran and then quickly rents it out to Jeffrey Epstein and only Jeffrey Epstein. You know, if we had the State Department files, if any brave member of Congress listening to this right now simply runs back the same bill, it got passed 427-1 and 99-0 in the Senate, and just calls it, for example, the Jeffrey Epstein Records Collection Act, mirrored after the JFK Records Collection Act that forced the CIA and State Department to turn over all files relating to JFK's assassination. The same could be done with the Epstein files, and we could see why it is that the State Department would choose Jeffrey Epstein and Jeffrey Epstein alone to rent this property out to in New York City. Now, a few things that are important to note here. New York City is the home of the UN General Assembly. It is where all foreign dignitaries from around the world come to stay, sometimes for a week or weeks at a time, while they engage in sensitive diplomatic and deal-making activity with the U.S. government. A five-story mansion overlooking Central Park is about as good a place as you could, private residence would basically allow Jeffrey Epstein to serve as a unofficial back channel for the Clinton administration to meet privately with foreign dignitaries or foreign oligarchs who are in New York City for these high-level international events. And Epstein could strike back channel deals. He could acquire information. He could speak in a language that is the reason that the CIA, the State Department, the National Security Council use back channels for so many things. In fact, our most recent CIA director, Bill Burns, the title of his autobiography is called "The Back Channel." Mm-hmm. It's literally about his role at State before he became CIA, and how you work through back channels to get commitments. That way, the government itself is not officially committed to what it says in the negotiation. Things are pre-negotiated and lined up by fixers and middlemen. Well, that would explain, certainly, Jeffrey Epstein's State Department. You and I can't just get the State Department as our personal landlord. That's that's not something you can find on Airbnb or on Zillow or whatever. But the fact is Jeffrey Epstein then got in trouble 4 years later he stopped paying the rent. The State Department let him skate by for an entire year without paying rent. $15,000. Now that rent is owed to the U.S. taxpayers. But what got him in trouble was that he violated the terms of the lease by subletting the apartment out to the criminal defense lawyer, a very high profile, famous criminal defense lawyer who represented the famous drug ring defendants in the Pizza Connection and French Connection drug cases, both of which are alleged to have heavy CIA involvement because both the Italian and French groups involved in those drug rings were formally assisted by the Central Intelligence Agency. So it had been alleged by the media that the CIA let these drug rings between the Corsicans in France and the Sicilians in Italy and their counterparts in New York City, running the unions and the dock workers. They let that go for 20, 30 years because these groups were being backed by the CIA and that the Justice Department had been waived off. So of all people for Jeffrey Epstein to sublease the apartment out to, it's to the criminal defense lawyer who would be the guy representing those folks that you need to make sure is on the good side of the agency so that he doesn't open up lines of evidence that might implicate agency facilitation of illegal narcotics, which would be a major international scandal, just as it was in the previous decade during the Iran-Contra affair, when Senator John Kerry at the time led the Kerry investigation into drugs, in which in 1997, John Deutsch, the head of the CIA, would have to travel to Compton in Los Angeles to effectively apologize to the black community about the big misunderstanding of around CIA drug dealing there. So Jeffrey Epstein is once again in this drug and gun network, about as close to the sun as you can get to the Central Intelligence Agency. What I want to know is, why did the State Department not enforce the rent? Why did it take so long to bring action around the violation of the lease? Was there CIA coordination with the State Department? The State Department is the CIA's boss. The CIA is only supposed to do covert action that assists a State Department foreign policy goal. Well, the State Department somehow decided that Jeffrey Epstein could advance their foreign policy goals. Was Jeffrey Epstein's meetings with folks there helping the CIA? Was the CIA leaning on the State Department to not bring action against that, against Epstein? Was there interagency chatter in the 1990s about what to do with the Epstein hot potato when he subleased it out to the criminal defense lawyer? Did the CIA, for example, send a classified cable to the White House or to the National Security Council saying, handle this delicately? This involves a highly sensitive matter. If that's the case, that to me is an international bombshell. And all it takes is one simple vote of Congress to force disclosure of that.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow. Viewers, put one in the chat if you haven't heard this before and you're blown away by Mike connecting the dots here, because I certainly haven't heard a lot of this before. Going back to what you said about the visits to the Clinton White House then, my understanding is that Mark Middleton was an intermediary there. Bill Clinton was present at some of the meetings. And a possible outcome that's been alleged is that technology was getting sold to China using the Wexner aircraft, and also nuclear codes were getting sold to Israel. Are there any credence to these things?
I don't know about that. There may be. I simply have not done enough to feel confident answering that question one way or the other. What I'd say is, certainly it was Nixon who did the opening to China. It was George Bush who was George H.W. Bush who was the U.S. ambassador to China and was you know, responsible for a significant part of its opening. We know that the Southern Air Transport airline, the CIA airline that moved to Rickenbacker Air Force Base in Columbus, Ohio, to serve the Limited, was primarily for to serve as a private charter airline back and forth between Hong Kong. Hong Kong, you know, obviously, you know, I guess at the time was formerly British. I believe it was in 1997 around thereabouts that the process of sort of folding it back into China began. But the fact is it's still a huge part of this. I mean, if you think about like a British bank closely associated with British intelligence and international drug running and covert action, you know, HSBC is one of these very famous banks. It's like the first thing you see when you get off, you know, at London Heathrow Airport, the first thing you see when you get off before you even go through customs, you see giant advertisements for HSBC, which has gotten in trouble more times than I think any historian can count around these sort of things. Well, that was the, you know, that was the Hong Kong Shanghai, you know, banking corporation, and it basically connected Hong Kong and the illegal, basically the narcotics and covert action trade that the Brits were running out of Hong Kong to Shanghai, and the, you know, so connected sort of the mainland and you know, kind of island land area there. The fact is you have this casino network in Macau, which is also, you know, technically part of this, you know, greater China, you know, area. And you've got this, you know, which is another way to clean money. You know, Sheldon Adelson and many others have this same sort of profile in terms of, you know, high level political donor, kingmaker, you know, these kind of joint U.S., Israeli, often British connections. I mean, there was a lot going on with China. I would not be surprised if you had private deal making, you know, or selling out certain things, you know, that you might acquire as an American through these channels to foreign countries in exchange for either money or some other in-kind, you know, deal or contribution. But I don't know that for a fact. What I'd say is I do think it's interesting that on his last day, Bill Clinton pardoned Mark Rich, who to me is a very similar figure to Jeffrey Epstein and to Bruce Rappaport and these other type figures. Mark Rich also had these U.S., U.K., Swiss, Israeli ties as an outside financier. I believe his lawyer in his noted his helpfulness to U.S. intelligence services as part of his plea for a pardon, which he then got. So, I mean, Bill Clinton was swimming all over this, and he appears to have been greatly rewarded when he's just 2 years later, after he left office and set up the Clinton Foundation, which Jeffrey Epstein's lawyers testified in court, Jeffrey Epstein helped set up, helped give them the idea for it. And now we're getting even more information that Ghislaine Maxwell continued, helping set up the Clinton Foundation and seed its initial class of donors or at least help set up the structure for it as it was recruiting those early donors in the early 2000s. And this, of course, is a giant pay-to-play operation in which foreign oligarchs and sovereign wealth funds can basically pay the Clintons Foundation, and the Clintons then effectively owe a favor. They put a favor in the favor bank when they in turn run U.S. foreign policy. Hillary Clinton, of course, would then run for Senate in New York. This was the sort of carpet bagging episode. And then she ran for president of the United States, became Secretary of State, where she would have had dominion over both the statecraft and intelligence portfolios of the United States. As Secretary of State, you can pull all sorts of levers for people who are simultaneously funding your private foundation, which is paying most of its, you know, most of that money goes to salaries for the people who work there. You can give yourself a, you know, $500,000 salary a year for effectively a no-show job, issuing out sub-grants to, you know, a random clean water project along the Nile, doing basically zero work and just collecting giant fat salaries with her own family, helping, you know, run the foundation. So this is part of what the Uranium One scandal was about. You had Russian oligarchs who were paying the Clinton Foundation, and then Hillary Clinton approving on the CFIUS board the sale of 20% of the United States uranium to Russia. This is during the Russian reset, the 2-year period under the Obama administration where Russia was the good guy. And but, you know, the argument at the time, the FBI actually opened an investigation into this and said, this looks like a criminal conflict of interest that should have been disclosed. The Russians were paying her foundation when she had the veto or approval right over the Uranium One deal. She approved it, didn't disclose that she was getting under the table millions from Russian oligarchs. This is a major ethics violation that may border on criminal. They opened 3 different criminal investigations in different branch offices at the FBI, and then the Justice Department under Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch shut it down. So, you know, they protect their own that way. The last thing I'd sort of say about this is maybe it's worth touching on this insane fake news story that you see many parts of legacy media running with around Epstein being actually a Russian asset, a Russian double agent the whole time. You know, given what I just said about the Russians and the Clintons and all this, I think that's maybe a funny thing if you want to hit that, but I defer to you.
No, I agree with you entirely. It's all deflection. You know, you've nailed it about the enemies within in intelligence, etc. And we've got about 20 minutes left to the hour. I'm here with Mike Benz. So if people have got any questions while we're live, please get them in the chat now. I mean, I've just sat here mesmerized listening to all of the research here that's gone into this. And
all this is on my X account, by the way. If you search any of these terms, if you search State Department Epstein, you'll see the thread, 20-some tweet thread that I did on, you know, on that whole thing and the selling it to the criminal defense lawyer. If you search, you know, for example, you know, for the CIA FOIAs that I mentioned, I did about 23 tweet thread on that. So all the receipts are all on my social media for anyone watching.
Yeah, here in the UK, they're blaming Epstein on the Russians because I think Keir Starmer and his cronies are slobbering all over the interest they're getting from the $300 billion in assets that were frozen. But let's get to the news story that's, you know, that's come out with the files and stuff. Why do you think it has taken this long to get to this place where we're actually seeing some of the files?
Well, I mean, we have Thomas Massie to thank for this. And, you know, this, what he did is may well end his political career. I mean, he went straight through the door to do this. I mean, think about this. This is, first of all, the CIA is not allowed to just, you know, turn over documents, and neither is the Justice Department, unless they are compelled to by something that supersedes the traditional protections that are supposed to be kept for investigative criminal, you know, for criminal investigations, if you're talking about the Justice Department or FBI, or classified documents, if you're talking about the State Department or Central Intelligence Agency. So it does require either an executive order or a legislative, you know, bill turning into a law that forces this under criminal penalty. And so, you know, I think that the reason that this was not done was because both sides of the political aisle are implicated in this. And so you have a kind of mutually assured destruction kind of pact, I think, when you get into the upper echelons of both sides of the Senate. I won't show you mine if you don't show me yours. You know, I mean, this is, it envelops both Clinton world, Biden world, Obama world, and Trump world, and has for a very, very long time. I mean, I mentioned Adnan Khashoggi, Epstein's client. I mean, Donald Trump in 1989 bought Adnan Khashoggi's yacht. I mean, that doesn't mean Trump did anything untoward with women. I doubt that was the case. It's come out that Donald Trump may have played a role in reporting Epstein to the FBI. It's unclear the extent to which people in this network knew the kind of other things Jeffrey Epstein was involved with. But the fact is whether it's, you know, what's come out around, you know, the revelations with Howard Lutnick and many other high level, like, you know, folks around the Trump world. These are things that even though they don't involve child sex trafficking or, you know, soliciting prostitution, it's a business relationship on both sides of the aisle. Like I said, he started really Epstein did during the Reagan administration. Well, it, you know, probably a third of the high level, Reagan administration people were part of the Trump government or still are today. I mean, during Trump one, our South America envoy was Elliot Abrams, who went to jail over Iran-Contra, or at least was criminally indicted and prosecuted over that. You had John Bolton as the national security advisor. He was Ronald Reagan's head of USAID policy and budget. You have an enormous donor class overlap. But the fact is Thomas Massey, I mean, if you think about this, it's really incredible. This Epstein Records Disclosure Act could have been done in 2019 when Epstein Epsteined himself in prison. It took Thomas Massey to sponsor that bill. Once it was sponsored, it passed 427-1 in the House. I've never seen that before in my life. And 99-0 in the Senate. So it was politically impossible. And he only did this, by the way, when effectively he had already put it all on the line. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene was one of the most gung-ho MAGA Congress people in all of Congress. And it was basically her sticking to the Epstein investigation that caused the massive fallout and blowback and isolation and ultimately dropping out from Congress. Thomas Massey is being primaried with extraordinary sums of money. The Republican apparatus is trying to get him out in significant part for pursuing this. But the fact is it was politically impossible without committing political suicide to sponsor this bill, but because of pressure from the donors and from, you know, the executive branch, but it was politically impossible to vote against the bill once it was live because of the voters. And so my perspective on this is, you know, I think everyone owes Thomas Massey, you know, some gratitude for his service in doing this. The mere fact that it passed by that margin at both chambers of the Congress tells you it was the right thing to do and that everybody else knows it was the right thing to do, but didn't want to be the person whose name was on the bill forcing this process. But look, in for a penny, in for a pound. Representative Massey, thank you so much. While you're here, you know, you can do the same thing for the CIA and State Department files. And I would wager that nobody would want to be on the other side of that either, saying, yes, I don't want to know. I want the Justice Department files, but I don't want the CIA and State Department files, which, again, we know there are, if nothing else, from the 1990s, New York City residence affair, and that the CIA wouldn't be doing its job if nothing else, let alone the logistics and covert facilitation. But if nothing else, is a counterintelligence threat because of all these other government intelligence services that he's working with and whose money he's handling. So we all know it's there. The question is who will be brave enough to knock down the door and endure another round of arrows, you know, front, back, and side, for doing the right thing.
Yeah, and put a one in the chat if you want us to reach out to Massey and Green and try and get them on to answer your questions, viewers. And you got tons of questions coming. We'll be here all night, but let me just home in on a few important ones then. Well, actually, the most common one, they're asking about the Clintons. You know, we've seen this tit for tat on X between Trump and the Clintons. Are they going to speak live in camera, closed behind doors, etc.? Is that just, again, theater?
Well, it depends. The fact is I think they're negotiating whether this is going to be a private 4-hour deposition on the record or whether it's going to be a kind of 2-hour public hearing. I would prefer it's a private deposition, frankly. The fact is private depositions are actually much more useful, even though the public spectacle of you know, having clips circulate on X or Instagram about a 30-second exchange where someone uses a weird word or gets owned is, you know, fun theater. The fact is most people who ask questions on congressional committees don't know, you know, they don't know their, you know, their butthole from their ear hole. I mean, they every member of Congress has 5 minutes of time to ask questions, and the level of expertise on the subject matter. I mean, the fact is the Epstein cinematic universe is a kind of PhD level, you know, geopolitics course unto itself. If you are a random, you know, a random congressperson who's mostly concerned with what's happening in Greenland and, you know, a trade deal with Europe or something, and you've heard a couple things about Epstein, you've got as much time as somebody who's dedicated, you know, the better part of a decade to looking into these networks does. And so you end up having kind of a couple minutes of interesting questions. And because the, you know, the witnesses know that, they can simply tie their shoelaces, deflect, run out the clock on the people who ask the hard questions. And then, but you can't do that in a 4-hour deposition, especially if the Justice Department official running the deposition is, you know, deeply informed and has months to prepare for that sort of thing or weeks to prepare for that sort of thing. So, but, you know, I think that there is this conflict again between the kind of higher levels. And again, I think this administration has done a fantastic job on a million different things. The fact is, on the Epstein thing, it is causing, the response is causing causing and then exacerbating a significant rift with the base. And I think when people see the president, whom I love dearly, you know, say that, you know, I see people going after Bill Clinton, they shouldn't do that, he's a nice guy. Well, Bill Clinton he defied a congressional subpoena. Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro were put in leg chains from their home and dragged out of their houses and at the crack of dawn by federal officials, who then put them in jail for months for doing what Bill Clinton did. It's not people going after Bill Clinton. That's the law as was enforced against Donald Trump's closest aides and allies. So the fact that when you see, oh, leave Bill Clinton alone, don't prosecute him for violating this law, while saying, you know, Epstein of, you know, we have to get over this. What's everyone talking about this for? You know, it does lean into, it does exacerbate a perception, I think, that is growing within the base that this is part of this mutually assured self-destruction thing, that by implying to Congress that they should not pursue this dialogue with Bill Clinton, it sends a message to future Democratic administrations that they won't haul the president in for questioning, you know, or his top aides for questioning. And if they were to attempt to do so, he could effectively invoke the favor that he put in the favor bank while he was president.
Yeah. Now, one of the tech billionaires we saw in the files was Peter Thiel. And you are getting asked about your thoughts on Peter Thiel and Palantir. And I'm watching Palantir stock price slipping and sliding right now. And Gates is Microsoft. That's been coming down as well. So do you think that the software that he's using, this AI software, then is like Promise on steroids kind of thing?
Well, I think there's a significant amount of Unit 8200 type software that does that. I mean, the fact is much of this is a kind of an unfortunate consequence of you know, the world in its present state. But the fact is that another reason that the alliance between the U.S. and Israel is what it is on intelligence matters is because, you know, the Unit 8200 Amman military intelligence type surveillance networks and technological capabilities are the best in the world, and the CIA does have to use them in many respects, and the NSA often, you know, works through that to be able to even get the signals intelligence or various levels of surveillance or network penetration that it has. And so there's, but on Palantir, you know, Palantir was formed in 2003. One of my, I think to this day, my favorite reveal in the Epstein files is Jeffrey Epstein secretly recording the head of the Israeli military at the time. This is in February 2013, Ehud Barak, who was the head of Israel's most elite covert commando unit. And then he became the head of Amman, Israeli military intelligence, which is about two-thirds bigger than the Mossad, from 1983 to 1985. So that would have made Ehud Barak the head of Israeli military intelligence during Iran-Contra, when Jeffrey Epstein's client, Adnan Khashoggi, was the Saudi middleman between American intelligence and Israeli military intelligence. So it's my opinion that Jeffrey Epstein came to know Ehud Barak in the early 1980s, and this is in 2013. This is effectively a 30-year relationship, at least at the network level, but it appears quite possible even at the personal or interpersonal level. But the fact is Epstein secretly records a three-hour conversation that he has with Ehud Barak as he is about to leave office in Israel, and he coaches Ehud Barak on how to make more money in the private sector by creating a list of people who owe him IOUs, a list of favors. You know, this is the Tom Wolfe Bonfire of the Vanities favor bank concept. It basically says if you want to make a lot of money, you have to create a list of people who owe you favors, owe you a job, owe you their life, owe you something, and call those in for your initial set of clients for your consulting business and venture capital funds for your VC business. And here's a $3 million board seat that you can join because of somebody who owes you a favor this way. I mean, it's a fantastic window into that fixer level between government and the private sector. But beyond that, after Jeffrey Epstein coaches Ehud Barak on how to make big money in the business world, leveraging all the people who owe him favors from his government service, he says, and you know, on this VC fund, you should look into these two companies owned by Peter Thiel. This is in February 2013. And the second company that he names is Palantir. Now, Jeffrey Epstein grossly misspells Palantir. It's almost something out of like a, you know, some slapstick comedy thing. You know, he says it's like P-A-L-L-E-E-N-T-Y-R-R. It's like a comedic that 10 years into Palantir's term. Palantir's first client was the CIA. That's their major CIA contractor. They effectively help, you know, the back end infrastructure of the CIA work. The fact that for the first 10 years of its existence, the head of Israeli military intelligence turned the prime minister of Israel, who Mossad answers to, turned the head of the Israeli military, after all those years, still didn't even know what Palantir was, because not only did Jeffrey Epstein not know how to spell it, but at least knew that it was a company that was real and owned by Peter Thiel. Ehud Barak listens to this, not knowing he's being secretly recorded, and says, I've heard of Peter Thiel, which implies that they had never met. Ehud Barak grossly misspells Peter Thiel's name, and then basically says he's never heard of Palantir. What does it do? How do you spell it? So 10 years into Palantir being effectively the CIA's back end, Israeli military intelligence, the prime minister who Mossad answers to, didn't know it existed. So, I mean, I think an anecdote like that, now it obviously shows that Jeffrey Epstein and Ehud Barak are trying to get to Peter Thiel at that point and get him to link up with these Israeli intelligence adjacent networks. But it shows that for at least the first 10 years, that was not the case. And there's no smoking gun around Peter Thiel actually. There is the Valar Ventures situation that came out, which has some, you know, edge touch points, but it doesn't, there's no kind of like formal agreement with the Israeli government. There's certainly, deal making around Israeli surveillance tech, or at least hypothesized dealings. We don't know what all was actually done or what ink was signed on a dotted line. But the fact is, you know, that's not unusual in this space, given that it's quite possible that the Israelis, the military intelligence and Unit A200 folks might have technology that a company like Palantir might find useful to enhance its own services. Of course, you don't know if they've got some, you know, kind of exploit that, you know, that they're kind of famous for inserting into these sorts of things. But it's unconfirmed, and most of the things that I've seen on this involve some degree of hesitation. It certainly wasn't proactive on Thiel's part to, you know, try to make contact with the Israelis. If anything, it was the other way around. You also have Jeffrey Epstein reaching out to Kathy Rumler around a meeting where he was supposed to meet Peter Thiel. And Kathy Rumler was the White House counsel for Obama, the top personal lawyer to Barack Obama when he was president of the United States. She discloses to Jeffrey Epstein that she won a CIA agency medal, one of the highest medals you can win at the CIA. She won it while she was a civilian, after she was no longer in government, which begs the question of what she was doing for the CIA as a civilian to earn that medal. But Jeffrey Epstein says to her, "I'm about to meet with Peter Thiel at this dinner party. Can you come and bring some of your spook friends?" So that implies that, you know, Epstein is trying to get CIA folks around Peter Thiel for whatever purpose, while Epstein's business partner, Ehud Barak, is trying to get effectively the Israeli side.
Wow, absolutely mind-blowing, Mike. Huge thank you for spending this time with us. And I've put Mike's links in the live chat. They're in the description box if you're watching on replay. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion to the viewers, Mike?
Well, I publish receipts and live streams and detailed written threads on this, you know, pretty much every day on my social media accounts. And you can find me pretty much everywhere, the social media. So for those who are interested in diving deeper into it, you know, the door is open for everyone. And thanks so much for making the time for me today. Appreciate your patience while I lay this out. And it's great to finally connect.
People are asking if you've written a book on the deep state yet.
I've been paused at about 270 pages on a manuscript that I realized would take 2,700 pages. And unfortunately, I'm becoming a character in the story I've been writing. So the, you know, it's at some point, I'm hoping before 2028, I will have that. But it is a dream. But for now, it's a dream deferred.
Yeah, put it out in a series of books. That way you can just keep popping one out every year or so. Yeah. All right, Mike, you have a great rest of your day, and I'm going to close the show. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.
All right, folks, please support Mike's work. Like I said, links in the live chat, and his links are in the description box if you're watching on replay. Love to hear about all the background of the intelligence apparatus. Absolutely fascinating, the connection with Wexner, the airlines. It was that crossover that brought me from the war on the substances to the human transportation stuff and Wexner and Epstein. And so tomorrow we've got Matthew Steeples on at 3 p.m. UK. Saturday, David Icke, 9 a.m. UK. 9 p.m. UK, Gloria Masters on Saturday. And then Hamamoto, Sunday night. So we're going full force throughout the weekend, folks. Stay tuned and get ready for the...
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.